Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to July 18th Committee on Rules. Got a little bill in front of us, House Bill 3457. Ms. Mowad, why don't you tell us about the bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. House Bill 3457A would amend existing civil and criminal forfeiture statutes. It would amend the civil forfeiture statutes by redistributing the proceeds from the forfeited properties, and it would also amend the civil forfeiture statutes by shifting the burden in incidents of real property to the government and establishing the standard of clear and convincing evidence for that. It would amend both the civil and criminal forfeiture statutes by adding what's known or referred to as the fugitive disentitlement doctrine, which essentially states that when a defendant or a property claimant is in warrant status or fails to appear in a case for a significant period of time, the forfeiting agency counsel can move the court for a default judgment upon filing an affidavit showing that good faith efforts have been made to locate the individual. It also would eliminate the sunset on the criminal forfeiture laws, which were enacted after Ballot Measure 3 was voted into law in 2000. To give you a little history, we had civil forfeitures up until 2000. In 2000, Ballot Measure 3 was enacted by Oregon voters, and it required, it amended the Constitution, was codified into statute during the 2001 legislative session, and required that the owner of the property sought to be forfeited had to be convicted of a crime. The burden of proof was placed on the forfeiting agency and elevated to clear and convincing evidence. That portion has a sunset clause. The enactment or the codification of Ballot Measure 3 has a sunset clause of July 31st of this year, and so this bill would eliminate that sunset provision. There are three sets of amendments before the committee today. The A7 amendments and the A10 amendments are very similar, and in fact, I believe that the people who put forth A7 would actually agree that the A10s are intended to supersede the A7s. What the A10 does is it shifts the burden to the forfeiting agency in both situations of personal property and real property. It leaves the burden of persuasion for personal property at preponderance of the evidence. It leaves the burden of persuasion in forfeiture actions of real property at clear and convincing evidence. It does change some of the distribution of proceeds. And finally, it states that if the forfeiting agency establishes in a forfeiture action that cash, weapons, or negotiable instruments were found in close proximity to controlled substances or instrumentalities of prohibited conduct, then that would essentially establish a prima facie case for the forfeiting agency, and the burden would shift to any person claiming the cash, weapons, or negotiable instruments were theirs and not proceeds from the criminal activity. The A9s, I believe what the A9s do, I am just seeing them for the first time today, but it appears to me that what the A9s do is take the changes to civil forfeiture law and criminal forfeiture law enacted by the legislature in 2001 and extends the sunsets of those to January 2nd, 2008.
Thank you. We got Senator Pozanski first. Do you want to come on up? And then do you mind if I bring up Representative Olson and Senator Burdick?
Oh, sure.
Okay. Why don't you come on up. Senator Burdick, Representative Olson.
And Madam Chair, what I would suggest is maybe going ahead and let Senator Burdick and Representative Olson go first, since I know Representative Olson was the author of 3457A, and I know they've been working together on the, I assume, the 7s and the 10s.
That's very kind of you. I will let them do that, even though you were here first. Go.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Chair Brown, and members of the committee. My name is Andy Olson, representative with the state legislature, actually from the Albany and Benton County areas. And thank you very much for hearing this today. I just want to, I know, I think most of you have pretty much done a great deal of study on this. Heidi Moe did a good job of explaining exactly what's going on with House Bill 3457. But I just wanted to kind of go through a couple little points here. Have a lot of folks in the back that are friends and colleagues that would like to also share and give a little different perspective too from their view. But the history on this, when session started back in January 10th, if you remember that far back, we at that time Chair Wayne Krieger of Judiciary on the House side had asked me to take a look at doing something with civil asset forfeiture because it appeared that a month earlier in December of last year, it had been argued in front of the Supreme Court that ballot measure three dealing with the asset forfeiture was unconstitutional. And as a result of that, he wanted me to take a look at seeing what we could do to come up with something of civil asset forfeiture in case the Supreme Court did rule and support what the lower court, the Court of Appeals, had done, finding that Measure 3 was unconstitutional. Well, as a result, what I did was I went back to the old law that was on the books of civil asset forfeiture and moved it forward, modifying it to what you're looking at today, House Bill 3457, in anticipation. And basically what this does is it stays in line with what the old law did with for disbursement of asset proceeds before disbursement, the following percentages of the proceeds from assets will be distributed to, and that's what I want to share with you quickly. 2.5% and 3% to the Asset Forfeiture Oversight Council, 5% and/or 10% depending on what agency you represented, to the Illegal Drug Cleanup Fund, which is part of the DEQ. And then a little different twist here because of the concern of what's happening in our state, specifically dealing with families that are being impacted with the use of drugs. We also focused at 20% of the proceeds going to drug court to try to help that out. And as you know, drug court has really been proven to be a huge asset and tool, and it's really turning some families around. The other thing, too, that we did with this bill was add 10% to relief nursery programs as well. So it's kind of neat and unique because what you're doing as a result of this is really bringing back restoration to the family and the community as a result of this. Some other different pieces that we changed with the law that's in 3457 for disbursement identified the guidelines for what law enforcement could use the dollars for. One of the wasn't a change, but it remained the same, was to purchase equipment necessary to combat narcotic activity. Use the dollars for buy money activities for illegal narcotic activities. Drug awareness and drug education programs offered in middle schools and high schools. That's a real key issue today. A lot of media attention toward that. Operating costs for narcotic teams, rental space, utilities, office equipment, etc. And then also expenses of district attorneys and criminal prosecution relating to narcotic activity. Now, there's two pieces here, and I greatly appreciate the help from Senator Burdick, too, because she's been on board and helped me through this as well as Representative Krieger. But the issue dealing with real property as well as personal property, and that's what's identified in the dash 10s. The real property originally was to elevate the burden of proof to clear and convincing. And the burden of persuasion and burden of proof shifted to the government. And then the personal property issue, which is a change too, shifts the persuasion of burden of proof to the government, but keeps the burden of proof at preponderance of evidence. And with that, I would request that you support the dash 10 amendments, and if you have any questions.
Thank you. Senator Burdick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, appreciate this opportunity to be here and to express my appreciation to Representative Olson for bringing me into his consideration of this issue from a very early stage, even before it went through a House committee. I come here today in my capacity as chair of the Senate Judiciary, long closed down, and also a member of the methamphetamine work group. I particularly appreciate the portions of this bill that provide more revenue from these forfeitures to drug courts and relief nurseries. In all of our hearings that we had on the methamphetamine crisis, the one thing that emerged at every hearing was that drug courts are extremely effective, and relief nurseries also play an important role in helping bring families together and deal with people's addictions. So I really appreciated Representative Olson's willingness and eagerness to provide funding for these very valuable programs, because what we're trying to do is stop the addiction. The asset forfeiture is a lot of people kind of have trouble understanding the role of civil forfeiture. It's not the same as a criminal proceeding. What civil forfeiture is it's another tool that is very, very useful in some circumstances, including in the drug issue, because you don't have the criminal highest legal standard of beyond a reasonable doubt that you have to contend with, and yet you do have protections for people who, you know, you have protections against irrational or inappropriate taking of property with the preponderance of the evidence standard and with the clear and convincing standard. What this really does is this bill will go nowhere. It will be moot if the court the Supreme Court overturns the Court of Appeals. This bill would only go into effect if the court throws out Measure 3 from the 2000 election. Without this bill, and if nothing is passed this session, and Senator Pazanski is going to talk about the alternative, which is to extend the current sunset, but if nothing is passed this session at all, then if the court does throw out civil forfeiture, Measure 3, from 2000, then we would revert to the previous law on civil forfeiture. The law enforcement people who came and put this bill together understood that there were grave public concerns with the previous system, that there probably were some at least potential abuses. And so what they did with House Bill 3457 was put sideboards in. They put sideboards on how the money is allocated, you know, in inserting drug courts. There was nothing about drug treatment in the original civil forfeiture law. And they also provided, more due process. I feel that the A10 amendments go even more in the direction of providing due process for people. But basically, what this would allow us to do is, when the drug mule is running their car from Mexico up to Pendleton to deliver a bunch of meth and they get caught, this provides another tool in addition to the criminal justice system to deal with that drug issue, and to actually put the proceeds — oftentimes there's a great deal of money involved in these situations — and to put those proceeds to good use to fight the meth epidemic and other drug issues in our state. So I want to commend Representative Olson for bringing this to us, and for being very, very willing to talk about changes and make a really a good bill out of this.
Thank you. Questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Farrioli.
I'm getting some emails from folks who are in the medical professions who are concerned about civil forfeiture and the standard of proof that's required being putting them possibly at risk for those folks who are very litigious and are looking to have some sort of civil forfeitures utilized, not in the criminal justice system, but in those cases where they believe they have been aggrieved or injured. And could you address the issue of use of this a civil forfeiture outside of the realm that we've been discussing. We've talked about meth. We've talked about as an adjunct to the criminal prosecution, so this is a civil action. Can it be brought outside of the arena of the drug issues or the law enforcement issues?
Actually, Chair Brown, that's a good question, and that's been asked before. Council could probably address that, but I also, there are some additional folks that are here, too, that could address that a lot better than what I could. But yes, the answer to your question, the fix down in the background liberty.
They're kicking it back to you, ma'am.
Vice Chair Farrelly and Madam Chair, members of the committee, I believe under the civil forfeiture law, you have to have engaged in prohibited conduct. And prohibited conduct is listed and defined in the statute as a violation of solicitation to violate, attempt to violate, or conspiracy to violate any provisions of ORS 475005-.285 and 475805 to 475999. And additionally, other conduct that constitutes the commission of a crime is described in 161515 that provides for civil forfeiture of proceeds or instrumentalities of the conduct. I mean, I guess that's the long answer. The short answer is, unless the medical professional engages in some sort of prohibited conduct, typically in violation of the drug chapters, the controlled substance chapters, or I think DUII, for example, is one where a car can be seized. I would say no, that the civil forfeiture statute could not be used to take back some pieces of the medical professional's practice. I, too, would somewhat defer to Ms. Vitalins, who's here from the Department of Justice and who has tried civil forfeiture cases. When she comes up, I would refer to her.
Madam Chair, that sounds like a three-rail bank shot. So let's refer it yet again to the.
Okay.
But that is a concern that was raised by some medical professionals, and I think what people are really after is the idea an exploration of whether or not ordinary conduct could trigger a civil forfeiture, or whether, in fact, it's tied closely enough to the criminal statutes that there has to be a violation in that area alleged before you actually get to the trigger. But there's enough confusion and enough concern that we need to explore the issue of that.
All right. Other questions?
Madam Chair?
Senator Ringo.
I guess following up a little bit on what Senator Farrelly mentioned about other contexts, you know, I've had conversations with a number of you folks about how this might impact the ability to impound automobiles for drivers who are driving without insurance or perhaps driving with a suspended license. And it's kind of an ongoing discussion I've had, and currently there must be a conviction, and I had a discussion with Dave Fidanke and some folks about, well, maybe you could do it administratively. I guess it's a subject I want to at least leave open for a little while and have and see whether there's room on this bill to allow for civil forfeitures for driving without insurance.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Ringo. Either one of you want to respond to that?
Actually, Chair Brown and Senator Ringo, again, I have somebody in the back, Mr. Bovac, would be
okay.
Some person
okay.
To address.
Good.
All right. We're going to set you two free. Representative Olson, we really appreciate you taking time out of your very busy schedule to join us this afternoon.
Madam Chair, it's certainly no busier than our schedules.
What about my schedule, Senator Brown? Senator Burdick, I know that the good Senate President is keeping you very busy. Senator Pruzanski, take it away.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I guess I want to respond to a couple of things that have been brought up and also go over a little bit more in detail. I think it's important that the committee understand who was involved in drafting House Bill 3457, as well as who was not involved. You'll be hearing testimony from others today that basically that this was a work in progress that came through multiple individuals. Well, the reality is the people who actually brought Measure 3 forward, and I was one of the consultants, advisors, in their drafting of this, I've spoken with the people that were part of that crew and team, and none of them were involved in the drafting of this. I was told early on that this was going to be an attempt to rework but maintain certain components that the voters passed when they passed Measure 3 in 2000. That measure passed by about 67% of the vote. I worked with the drafters for approximately a year, a year and a half period of time prior to that, and they did polling to just determine what the heartbeat was for Oregonians as to what they thought was important in regarding forfeiture. The one thing that was very clear and was very drawn out and shown through the surveys is that most people that you asked on the street about asset forfeiture, they thought that before an asset forfeiture could actually occur involving criminal activity, is that you actually had a conviction of the individual for the crime that had been alleged. And that's not the case. Pre-Measure 3, and I would submit to you under the Dash 10s as well as the original House Bill 3457, no convictions necessary, no charges necessary, no arrests necessary. All that has to be is the allegation. Now, it's true that when you look at the shifting of the burden as to setting it at a different level, it is greater under the Dash 10s than what pre-Measure 3 was, because there was just probable cause, very simple. Now it's basically clear and convincing. And all that basically says, and we'll use the example of a residence. If someone was alleged to have had a conduct on their property, let's say you own property, you're renting it to a renter, and there was a operation and determined that drugs were being sold out of that house, they would have to determine, they'd have to show to a court by clear and convincing evidence that the residence was used for the transaction. That's it. They would just have to show that the house was actually the location by clear and convincing evidence. It'd be pretty quick and pretty succinct to be able to do that. You'd meet that burden without much else. What isn't required under the Dash 10s, as well as the original bill, is a conviction for the individual that owns that property. Under pre-Measure 3, you have claimants, individuals who may have an interest in the property, who have to basically come forward as a claimant and file a claim for the property, because the lawsuit is not against the individual, it's against the property that's been accused of being involved in wrongdoing. And so many times you see the state of Oregon versus name off a vehicle, name off the residence of a house, and that's the defendant. It's not the person who owns or has an interest in it. Those individuals have to actually come in and assert their interest as a claimant. So Measure 3 basically set forward that it says that you can in fact seize property just like you can, you could before Measure 3, based on the allegation. Seizure has not been changed. But before you could actually forfeit the property, convert it to ownership of the governmental entity or entities, you had to have a conviction for the individual that was alleged to be involved in that incident and do a nexus as to the property that's alleged actually was in fact somehow involved either in the direct action conduct or was a result assets proceeds from that conduct. Now, what I would ask you to do is look at where we're at today. Measure 3 is definitely under a legal challenge. The Circuit Court in Marion County agreed with the proponents of Measure 3 and basically ruled it to be constitutional. The Court of Appeals took a different position and said no, it wasn't constitutional, violating the single subject rule.
Senator Prusansky, which court did it come out of, which county, and who was the trial court judge?
It's Marion County, and I'm not sure who the trial court judge was.
Okay.
And then so it's now pending before the Supreme Court. At the beginning of session or close thereafter, it was the buzz that the court was going to come out with its decision sometime in March or April. Well, we're now in July. We don't know when that decision is going to come out.
The good news is, Senator Prusansky, we may be here till August. So.
And it may be. It could come out today.
Madam Chair, you said that was the good news.
Well, if you're waiting for the court's ruling.
And so at this point, I would say it's premature to go in and basically gut the Measure 3 as it was presented to the voters and what the voters said. I think there's a couple of issues that the court's going to struggle with. One is regarding not only the conviction, but also
how the proceeds could or could not be used, limitations on its use within law enforcement.
Can I ask you a question? Do you agree or disagree with the Court of Appeals ruling? I assume it was Armada, based on the Armada decision.
It's based on Armada. Based on my review, I think that it's still a close call, because I think that the question that the court's going to have to determine is whether or not the second question regarding the use of the proceeds was closely tied and sufficiently tied to the need for a conviction. Either way, I think that I can tell this committee that the polling was very clear. Individuals in this state believe, and I think still today believe, that before the government takes ownership of personal private property or personal real property, there should be convictions if you're going to allege criminal wrongdoing. So what we're asking in the Dash 9 amendments, I will take credit for them, as well as Senator Westland. Senator Westland and I put forward the Dash 9s that will basically extend the sunset for 2 years, actually till January of 08, and would in fact require the Asset Forfeiture Oversight Advisory Committee to do work during the interim to actually address this issue, where you would have what I call a level playing field of parties from all perspectives at the table to determine what would be a better solution if the court does in fact come back with a affirming the Court of Appeals decision. This would stay true. This would be the truest, reflection of doing what the voters, I believe, intended to have happen. That was to require the conviction. And at this point, I think what we couldn't be able to do until the public is that we are, in fact, carrying forward those desires, that intent of the vote that was in November 2000. Now, I want to address a couple of concerns that have raised to Senator Farioli. I do agree that I believe that under the current civil forfeiture, it does have to have something dealing with controlled substances to be tied into how the forfeiture language is written. It was not a overbroad, including any and every type of conduct, but was...
You mean under current civil...
Under current.
Okay.
And that's pretty much what is required under the Measure 3 as well. It's just basically the difference from pre-3 to post-3 was basically conviction and then how the assets could be distributed. It should be noted that we've heard, and I think it's very important that we look at the distribution that has been put forward under at least the original bill. I have not had a chance to look at the Dash 10s to see if it's as inclusive, but that formula of distribution to those very worthy causes does not occur until after costs are paid. And the bottom line is, under the original bill, there was no limitation as to what the level or cost would be. So before you think that you're going to be sending money and proceeds to these very worthy causes, drug court, relief nurseries, you have to realize that they're going to first take whatever cut it is for cost. And I think there will be numerous people that will be testifying today that will go in greater detail if you want to question them as to what those costs include. I do understand that at least prior to Measure 3, there was one county in the state that said 85% of basically would go for cost. And so if that's the formula they use, you can figure of 85% of whatever money comes in is going to go away for cost, then you only have 15% left to be divided in those other areas. The I will commit to this body, this committee, as well as to the legislature in whole. One of my assignments in the through the President's office is on the Asset Forfeiture Oversight Advisory Committee, and I would be more than willing to be part of that group that would, in fact, take forward the what the Dash 9 requires is us to actually sit down and work through a process to determine what would be most advantageous for all parties concerned, and making certain that we deal with the issues that need to be dealt with, but ensure the public that we're not going to see forfeitures that are occurring on something less than substantial evidence, and I would say convictions or something close to that level, before the government would take care or take ownership of personal property or real property.
Thank you. A couple quick questions, Senator Przanski, and then my guests have got other members who have questions for you as well. I assume that you raised the issue of the dollar amount that law enforcement agencies are able to garner under the current proposal. I'm assuming one of the reasons for ballot measure three, limiting it substantially, the funds law enforcement's able to garner under the bill, is the fact that they didn't, that voters or the drafters of the measure didn't want any incentives, financial incentives. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, that's correct. I want to put on the record, there was a large work group that worked on this. I lost that argument because I felt that that once you had a conviction, that then you actually had this go before a jury or a judge, and they've reached that threshold, then I thought that it would be reasonable to see a distribution that would include and allow for law enforcement to receive some of those proceeds for their continual operation. But at the same time, you needed to have a conviction, something that actually went through this process. Now, it should be noted that when after Measure 3 did pass in the 2001 legislature, which I was not a member of, I did come up for two or three of the initial meetings. There was a work group put together to actually put together what is criminal forfeiture, and that's what the state has been operating under for some period of time. Under the criminal forfeiture, there was a procedure and an allowance for law enforcement to get a percentage of the proceeds to be used. Now, to this date, I cannot tell you why the criminal forfeiture was not used and more fully than it was being used, because I was told through many of my colleagues as prosecutors that they were getting convictions on these underlying charges. And to me, if you're all only requiring was the conviction through the criminal process before you could actually get a distribution back to law enforcement, I'm not sure why that didn't happen. I think personally it was probably a political decision that was made to basically do the frontal attack that you now see on Measure 3.
A couple of other questions. Who were the crafters of ballot Measure 3? Do you know those folks?
Crafters included, I know the ACLU was involved. There were, Mr. Sugarman was representing a group of different individuals. We had an attorney here that dealt with initiative process, was involved out of Portland. There were two or three other organizations that were involved that had individual members that participated in conferences or telephone conferences in the drafting process. It was a process that multiple drafts were done and then shared with various different groups and individuals, and based on comments that was received, then it was narrowed into the initiative that was presented to the voters.
Okay. I didn't have the good fortune to serve on Senate Judiciary Committee this session, but my recollection is that the meth scourge is more recent in the last couple of years than it was about the time voters voted on this. Do you think that voters might have a different response given what's happening to our communities because of meth?
Absolutely not. The one thing, and when I go out into communities now and we talk about forfeiture, I have yet to have anyone say that the government should be able to take someone's personal private property or their real property without a conviction when they're alleging criminal wrongdoing.
Okay. Questions for Senator Przanski? Senator Ringo.
Thanks. Floyd, we've talked about this, but do you have a problem with an administrative proceeding where if somebody's unable to show proof of insurance, their car is seized?
Yeah. No, it's not. And Madam Chair and Senator Ringo, the reality today, and there are numerous departments, the one that I work with the most, Florence Police Department, they actually do, in fact, impound vehicles immediately based on the criteria of not having insurance, or if it's DUII, and they'll take those in to custody through they use a rotating rotating list of tow companies, and those companies themselves actually are able to close on those vehicles if they're not paid for. And so I actually think the issue that you've raised is already permissible under Oregon law to actually take the vehicle and process against it. And what you're talking about when you're talking about no insurance is a violation. It's very simple, very straightforward case that goes before a court and in front of a judge, and he or she can make a decision within a very short period of time based on on whether they did or didn't have the proof.
But it still requires a conviction.
It does require a conviction, but they also, I think, through the administrative process of the toll company, I believe that they can, in fact, actually close on it as to paying off the cost of the debt that's been incurred by the impoundment.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? Yes. Senator Shields.
Senator Brzezinski, for the last 8 or 10 years, I've owned rental property. If I owned a house and didn't know what was going on in that house, are you saying that I could lose the house if somebody was selling drugs out of that house, even though I didn't know about it as a property owner?
Madam Chair, Senator Shields, what I'm saying is that what would have to happen is that you would have to actually come in as a claimant and essentially put a claim in for the property, and then there is an innocent owner defense that you would have to basically go forward with to demonstrate that you had no knowledge or should have had any knowledge as to what was going on. If they demonstrate that you had been told by a neighbor that weird things are happening at the house, people are coming all times of day or night, then I think that your burden would be greater than if you, let's say, were an out-of-state landlord, had no direct ties to the property except for receiving the rental checks.
Thank you.
Thanks. Thanks, Senator Brzezinski. We appreciate you joining us. Dina Vidolins. I was going to bring up Rob. Mr. Bovet. And why don't we bring up another lawyer because we don't have enough. Jason Carlisle. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Go ahead.
Thank you. Chair Brown, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to testify this afternoon. I've submitted previously written testimony, and I don't intend to go over that. I do have a few remarks to make. I'm a senior assistant attorney general with the District Attorney Assistance Program, and I have been more or less involved with civil forfeiture since the early 90s. I would like to answer the questions that were asked, that were thrown out first, and then make a brief closing statement. First of all, if I might, Senator Farioli, there is no private right of action in a civil forfeiture case. An individual may not bring a civil forfeiture action. It must be the state or a political subbody of the state, a city, or county. And it would have to involve prohibited. It would both have to be a government agency plus prohibited conduct, which would be delivery, sale, or possession of illegal controlled substances. And so that's the answer to the question about whether there's a private right of action. Second, Senator Brzezinski talked about costs. The Dash 10 amendments only allow you to recover costs in a civil forfeiture case for attorney fees, storage, towing, and publication. And the thing that's very important to remember is that all forfeiture actions must be approved by a judge, and we are required, when we file that civil forfeiture action, to put our costs and attorney fee bill in. And it's unless the judge approves that, it's not recoverable. I represent the Oregon State Police in civil forfeiture actions, and we never claim attorney fees. We claim costs of publication, towing, but not storage, and that's where the Oregon State Police is. And I understand many other places do not request recovery for attorney fees. Next, in response to Senator Brzezinski's response to the question of Senator Shields, your question was, if I have no idea what's going on my property and there's somebody dealing drugs or growing marijuana, may I lose my property? The answer to that is vehemently no. In Oregon, a real property case must be filed in court. You do not have to file a claim. We must prove by preponderance of the evidence in the Dash 10 amendments that you knew or you acquiesced in the prohibited conduct. And based on the facts that you've given, well, if we seized your property, we would be writing you a large check after you decided to file an action against us. So there's no possibility that we could forfeit your property based on the facts that you gave us. Finally, I just wanted to say briefly that what House, oh, I wanted to say one thing, too. Senator Perzanski said that there were no negotiations with any of the usual players involved in forfeiture in the civil forfeiture arena, and I'd like to point out that Senate Bill 243 was introduced without any negotiation with law enforcement, introduced before 3457, and basically permanently enacted ballot measure 3, and so I'd like to point that out as well. Finally, I'd like to say that the Attorney General supports 3457A and the Dash 10 amendments as a good compromise for civil forfeiture, and that the most important part of 3457A with the Dash 10 amendments is that it shifts the burden of drug enforcement from the taxpayer to the drug dealers. Thank you.
Thank you.
For the record, Rob Bovette, legal counsel for the Oregon Narcotics Enforcement Association, and I guess more importantly for the Lincoln Interagency Narcotics Team, LINT. I'm the one who brought the action challenging Measure 3 in Marion County Circuit Court at the Court of Appeals, and we're now waiting for the decision out of the Supreme Court. I'm really more interested in answering your questions. I think there's a lot of misinformation about civil forfeiture out there. I think in part it's deserved in the sense that civil forfeiture is kind of a backwater of the law, but because it's kind of a backwater of the law and a bit complicated, a lot of folks have a misimpression. I think it's important to understand that Measure 3, in addition to, in my strong opinion, being unconstitutional because it log-rolled 8 changes into a single measure, Measure 3 broke what was fixed. Civil forfeiture wasn't broken before Measure 3. It was working. It was helping to fund their narcotics teams around the state of Oregon. We've lost 35% of our narcotics teams since Measure 3. It's decimated us. It's decimated the remainder of the teams. We desperately need to restore civil forfeiture, not only for that aspect, but also because, and I just charted out on the back of this kind of written testimony, kind of some of the yeses and nos, kind of to make it a little more simple. The first box enables meth dealers to avoid forfeiture of ill-gotten gains by putting drug proceeds into a third party's name. This is the beauty of civil forfeiture, and always has been the beauty of civil forfeiture. It essentially precludes drug dealers from hiding their proceeds by putting it into somebody else's name. And this is the way civil forfeiture was used to chase down drug asset proceeds, particularly from meth dealers. The first case I had to reject following Measure 3 is when I had to return over $10,000 to a meth dealer because he was only going to be convicted of two deals we caught him with, about $200 worth, and I had to give him back his other $10,000 because we weren't going to convict him of those other 50 or 500 drug deals. That's the beauty of civil forfeiture. Criminal forfeiture can't make up for that. It can't cover those types of cases. There are other pieces that civil forfeiture can cover that criminal forfeiture can't. It is an effective tool in the toolbox. One of the most powerful pieces that precluded basically horror stories from the civil forfeiture scheme that we had in place for 10 years. You didn't hear any horror stories or poster children out of the state civil forfeiture system. They drummed up a few out of the federal system, but they couldn't find any in the state system. I think largely because not only do forfeiture counsel like Dinah and myself try to do the best job we can and not hurt people that don't need to be hurt, but also because from the very beginning the Forfeiture Act had an attorney's fees provision. The attorney's provision is a huge disincentive to going after someone kind of like the hypothetical that Senator Shields presented. If I go after an innocent owner and I lose the case, which I will lose the case, I get to write a big check for attorney's fees. It's quite a huge disincentive to me and my client. So it's a valuable tool to cut into drug profits as we shift the drug universe and the meth epidemic from local toxic meth labs, which we're in the process of doing, to the bulk dealers, the six cartels that are bringing in 65% of the meth into our state. We need an effective tool to intervene and take the profits out of drug dealing. We don't have an effective tool right now in the state of Oregon. 3457. I got to tell you, I don't like 3457, but I'm willing to live with it because I think it makes some effective compromises. It reforms a system that, albeit, in my opinion, didn't need reforming. It does make some reforms, enhances some burden of proofs, further protections for potential innocent property owners, even though we didn't have poster children, willing to make those concessions. But I'm not real happy with 3457 because, again, I think it broke. Measure 3 broke what wasn't in need of any fixing. I also provided at the bottom, and we talk about, you know, the will of the voters. I have a real tough time with the will of the voters in Measure 3, because of the eight pieces in Measure 3, what was the will of the voters? Did the voters support this piece? Did they support the one-to-one correlation requirement? Did they support the disconnect on civil forfeiture and law enforcement? Did they support the criminal conviction requirement? Did they support prohibiting local law enforcement from getting federal forfeiture proceeds? I don't know what they supported. I don't know what they didn't. That's exactly why Measure 3 is unconstitutional. I think in order to explain how, frankly, we got tubed in law enforcement, I think you just need to look at the bottom line on the back sheet. The Oregonians for Property Protection, which, of course, was in bulk funded by the out-of-state consortium of billionaires bent on drug legalization, you know, spent nearly $500,000, you know, and we managed to wrestle up, looks like, a little over $3,000 to oppose the measure. We got tubed. We deserve to get tubed. I can't say it any other way. I mean, when we throw up $3,000 against an onslaught of out-of-state billionaers that are going to spend $500,000 on a campaign,
and that's,
you know,
never happened before.
Never
in
happened
the
before. No. But the bottom line is that I think House Bill 3457, even with the Dash A10 amendments, is probably a good bill. Again, I'm not real happy with it because I think we had Measure 3 break something that wasn't in need of fixing, and we're now further and further deeper into our meth epidemic, and law enforcement needs effective tools, and we need to bolster up our three-legged stool. It's great that we're passing this meth package, 2485 and 907, but without restoring some of our narcotics team, without further funding things like drug courts and relief nurseries, we're really not putting any money, and we're letting drug dealers keep their profits. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions. I know I've rattled on here kind of free for all for a while.
Mr. Carlisle.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate you taking the time to listen to me today. My name is Jason Carlisle. I'm the district attorney in Linn County. I'm here speaking for myself only today. I'm not representing any groups or any other organizations. I'm here to speak in favor of the Dash 10 amendments from a practitioner's point of view. My professional life is consumed largely with the drugs and the byproducts of drugs, and I'm losing. And I need some tools in my bag because I got precious few tools to attack the guys that are buying and selling and cooking meth. Heaven knows we don't have much in terms of sentencing these people. And what we've got now doesn't work. I'm here to tell you that criminal forfeiture doesn't work. And let me give you one reason why. The guys that I really want to get, the guys with a lot of money and a lot of drugs, they just go to the doper bank and bail out, and I never see them again. And convicting them is mighty hard when they have a full, unlimited bank supply to bail out whenever we catch them. In fact, in Albany, we had one guy, five times we got him. He goes back and bails out every single time. Some of these guys with the high rolling, you can't catch them, and you can't get them convicted. So waiting for a criminal conviction just doesn't work. So I'd like to speak in favor of Dash 10. I don't think it's the best of all possible worlds. I agree with my colleague here that we could do better, but I think it's a good compromise, and I think it's definitely a step in the right direction.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Farrelly.
Madam Chair, as I've discussed with you at length and the proponents of the bill, I've got lots and lots of folks who are very nervous about the idea that we don't need a criminal conviction to go to civil forfeiture. Why is that standard being relaxed? Why do you think that's so necessary? Isn't the standard for criminal convictions supposed to be high? Isn't that part of the protections for civil rights and citizenship built into our Constitution that the bar on a criminal conviction is very high? It's beyond a reasonable doubt. Isn't it supposed to be that way?
Mr. Bovet, do you want to take that one?
Sure, I'll give it a try. I think we have to go back to the historical origins of civil forfeiture, which takes you back to the very first act of Congress, which provided for civil forfeiture of pirate ships and privateering ships, when we couldn't reach the actual people behind this conduct, we went and we took their property that was engaged in the illegal conduct. I think that's no different than what we're seeing right now. Six major meth drug trafficking organizations involved in bringing in lots of meth. We're never going to reach those folks. Not since they never. It's very difficult to reach a lot of those critical folks and criminally convict them. It's also real easy for those folks to put those proceeds into other people's names. And that's what we're seeing. You know, you can have a drug dealer putting money into grandma's name or into mom's name. And if we can trace the drug proceeds there, we can reach that with civil forfeiture, and we can't reach it. And they know we can't reach it with criminal forfeiture.
Senator Farrell.
Well, Madam Chairman, the question got answered, but perhaps not in the way you intended it to. We commissioned privateers in that period, at the beginning of our history. And they were simply licensed pirates. So you're certainly not suggesting that we create a privateering system for law enforcement. I mean, I don't think you'd do that.
Madam Chair, Senator Farrelly, no, I'm not suggesting that at all. I'm just suggesting the historical origins of civil forfeiture date back to the origins of this country, when we were trying to cut into criminal organizations that were essentially interrupting our governmental processes and our public safety, when we couldn't reach the true bad actors behind that conduct, many of which were in foreign lands. And that's no different than today.
Madam Chair.
Senator Farrelly.
I just have two other issues. One is that I'd like to hear...
Only two?
Just two. The little ones. A discussion of clear and convincing. Who makes the decision? What's the standard here?
Okay. And actually, it would be helpful for one of you three lawyers to walk through sort of the different levels, what's talked about in the Dash 10 amendments, and why you think that we should feel comfortable with that particular standard of evidence.
And Madam Chairman, before we have that, because I think that's really the meat on the plate here, can I refer back to an exhibit that was used here? I don't know why you would think that demonizing the consortium of out-of-state billionaires and connecting that with some kind of a hoodwinking of Oregon voters who were duped into supporting this measure. That's what it sounds like you're saying. First of all, who are these out-of-state billionaires that you referred to here? I want the names. You just can't walk into the Senate and
it's
say
George Soros.
George Soros. Well, yeah. I told him, but he didn't believe me.
I want to know who the consortium of out-of-state billionaires are.
Senator Brown, Senator Farrelly, I think you've heard the name here.
I've heard the witnesses talk about who it is.
George Soros and his organization. You can look them up on the Internet. They change their names periodically. I think if you Google Campaign for New Drug Policies, you'll get their new name. It's very similar. I think they're based in Florida now, but I could be mistaken. It's been a while since I've looked them up.
Gosh, that's a very familiar name. He was active in some other campaigns as well, wasn't he?
That is correct, Senator Farrelly.
All right.
Heaven forbid that we would allow billionaires to participate in Oregon and make a difference on policy. Okay, can we go back to the standard of evidence? Could one of the three of you walk us through the different standards and why this particular standard was chosen? And bear in mind, you got two lawyers on the committee, and one of us hasn't done any criminal law since law school, which was a very long time ago, with the exception of a few probation violation hearings in the early 90s.
Senator Brown, I'll take a shot at it. Basically, the two burdens of proof that are listed in 3457A-10 amendments are clear and convincing evidence for real property and preponderance of the evidence for personal property. So preponderance of the evidence for personal property, the government would have to prove by 51% that the property is an instrumentality or proceeds of prohibited conduct. Preponderance...
More likely than not.
More likely than not. That's correct.
So slightly better than a coin toss, Madam Chair.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. And then for clear and convincing, that is between, it's just below beyond a reasonable doubt. It's the highest standard below beyond a reasonable doubt.
75%?
I'd say more, 80 to 85.
Okay.
I at one time prosecuted termination of parental rights cases, and I would say those are clear and convincing, and I would say 80 to 85%.
Okay. Beyond a reasonable doubt, in percentage terms, 99.9%?
That's what I would believe, yes.
Okay.
The big change is that there's no shifting. The individual who, the, we, we seize the property and we have to prove the entire case. Where before it was probable cause, the government would show by probable cause, the burden would then shift to the personal property owner to prove that it was not. And so now it would be preponderance, and the government has to prove every element of the case, or clear and convincing in real property cases, and that the government has to prove that entire case.
Madam Chairman, it was a good answer. The frustration I have with this issue is that I've tried to support law enforcement at every opportunity throughout my career as a state senator representing people, because I believe that's a really important thing to do. This has me very upset and conflicted, because the constituents that I represent voted in large measure to support Measure 3. And now the proponents come to say that they somehow were fooled or duped. That I have a problem with. Or that they voted for an unconstitutional measure 8 different ways. Okay, I mean, that's the problem I'm having is that the standard of evidence issue is going to really affect the people's perception of fairness. I was convinced that this was a very good step to restore the tool that you discussed in the toolbox. Constituents didn't agree. They say it well, this thing may pass the standard of the legal test, that it doesn't pass the fairness standard. And I haven't heard anybody address the issue of whether or not relaxing the standard from from beyond a reasonable doubt to a place where we have merely to convince a judge in an administrative issue that we have clear and convincing evidence by a margin of 1%, yet from 50 to 51%. I'm not sure that passes the fairness standard. And I want to help law enforcement accomplish their objectives, but I'm concerned that moving to a 51% standard does more damage to general support for law enforcement than we perhaps can measure at this point.
Can you step out for me upstairs?
I'm ready.
I'll let you take the gavel. The next folks up. Let's call these folks up.
Senator Shields.
I had a question to ask. Given Senator Farioli's questions and a lot of other issues, other people's questions, I've heard you comment on dash 10s. What's the matter with the dash 9s? Just giving us a couple years to figure this out.
I guess, Madam Chair, Senator Shields, the problem is it perpetuates the harm for another 2.5 years. We're already in the midst of our meth epidemic. We believe we are close to restoring this toolbox that wasn't broken before as soon as the Oregon Supreme Court issues their opinion. We believe this compromises that and makes further reforms to a system that wasn't broken before. And we think that's an appropriate approach at this point in time, but to simply perpetuate the misery for another 2.5 years will not enable the restoration of the 35% of the narcotics teams that we've lost, the devastating damage we've done to the remainder that are out there when we desperately need them to utilize the other tools that we're giving them in House Bill 2485 and Senate Bill 907, the meth package. It's wonderful to pass these things that enable us to do our three-legged stool of prevention, enforcement, and treatment, but unless we start to restore some of our resources to do those things, we're whistling Dixie.
Did you get your question answered, Senator?
Well, I guess I got it answered. Yeah.
If the court rules, what is the and Measure 3 is declared unconstitutional in its various parts? Do we revert to the previous Civil Forfeiture Act?
Mr. Chair,
the thing that you characterize as being not broken?
Yes, we do. If you do nothing, the legislature does nothing at this point in time, and the court rules Measure 3 unconstitutional, upholds the Court of Appeals decision, then we are restored to status quo ante pre-2000. We will have that full tool in our toolbox without compromise as exists in House Bill 3457. the comment about the constituents, I guess the concern I have is that sometimes I see constituent polls come back with information based on not complete information going in. My daddy always used to call it garbage in, garbage out. But fundamentally, I think a lot of folks don't realize essentially what's in box number one here, that if we require a one-to-one correlation criminal conviction requirement, we will never be able to deal with the drug proceeds and the huge amounts of drug proceeds we're seeing made on the meth trade right now. We'll only be able to convict the actual low-level person at the bottom of the chain for those specific deals that we took them down for through our local officers and forfeit that exact dollars. Often it's the same buy money, the dollars we purchased the drugs with, so we get that back. But we were never able to reach and break down those meth trafficking organizations, and that's what civil forfeiture was designed to do way back in 1989 in Oregon and even earlier in the federal system.
Yes, Senator Shields has a follow-up.
So as I listen to your testimony, you've got me thinking here. Senator Farioli did a good job of pointing out his constituents and mine really believe that a conviction ought to precede the final step in a forfeiture. And you're arguing that you can never get the conviction of the people that are really behind it. All you get is the convictions of the little guys kind of in the front lines.
Sometimes.
Okay. When ballot measure 3 was argued in the public, do you think it would have made a difference if the voters had understood that most of this drug, and I suppose that Senator Brown asked the question in a different way, but do you think it would have made a difference if they would have had all of that information about how hard it is to get a conviction and how civil forfeiture might be the only way to make a dent in this? That's the first part of my question. And the second part is, as it has been operated, has civil forfeiture itself had some big kind of what I might call questionable holes in it by the quote-unquote maybe misuse of some of that money? I mean, 85% costs. How'd you ever get the 85% costs listed, considering the list of things that, you know? So I got a couple questions there, and I'm answering them both.
Let's address them both. Mr. Chair, Senator Shields, first, in terms of do I think it would have made a difference, we'll never know for sure, but spending, you know, $3,000 on a campaign in opposition wasn't effective. Similar measures did, however, go to defeat, such as in Massachusetts at the same time, where law enforcement was much more effective at mustering the forces and telling the truth from the other perspective about what civil forfeiture is useful for and what it's not useful for. In terms of the abuses, I don't know where the 85% came from.
Senator Brzezinski.
I'm not sure what county that is. I can tell you in Lincoln County, in 10 years of being Lincoln County's forfeiture council, actually 13 years now, but for the last 3 or 4 years there hasn't been any civil drug asset forfeitures because of Measure 3, I can tell you that I didn't take a dime of costs. And that's because I wanted to, and my bosses wanted to fund to the maximum extent possible that three-legged stool. So they didn't want me taking costs off, so I didn't. I think you'll find that to be the case in many of the smaller communities. Chatted with my colleague from Multnomah County, and they even were there where they can take a bigger share. I don't think they ever approached 85%, but maybe there is a county out there where they were taking 85% off the top. I would think that would create an internal problem for them, you know, kind of social, politically, because you would have the local narcotics team and whoever else is there saying, why are you sucking off all these proceeds when we need it to support operations so we don't die? So I'm not sure what the story is behind all that, but it's hard for me to defend it when I don't understand where it's coming from.
Did you have some comments?
Yes, Senator Farioli, Senator Shields. The two comments I wanted to make is that I know that for myself, when ballot measure 3 was proposed, I was fairly arrogant about the whole thing. It's ridiculous. Why would anybody not want to fund law enforcement? Why wouldn't anybody want law enforcement to receive federal forfeiture dollars? And being a civil forfeiture counsel, I knew that I didn't go around targeting innocent people's property. I think we did in total 9 real property cases. And so I think one of the things is we kind of sat back and said, people are going to see through this, and didn't do really anything. And so because I talked with my neighbors about that, and they said, well, we think we're going to vote in support about Measure 3. I said, are you kidding? And they said, well, we all have rentals, and we've seen that poor guy on TV, and if you guys find a drug grow there, we're going to lose our property. And I said, that case does not reflect civil forfeiture in Oregon. It was an inaccurate statement of the federal forfeiture case as well. But when I explained it was a federal case, that in the state court you have to file a judicial action. You can't. You have to be served with a complaint, and we've got to prove that that property that you knew or acquiesced in that prohibited conduct. I was able to explain that. And the other thing I just mentioned is I testified in support of this legislation in Coos Bay when the Senate and Judiciary Committees met there. And I ran into two couples who had come. They were retired and had rental properties, and they'd come specifically to hear about this. And they were very, and they said they came. They were adamant about not supporting any change to civil forfeiture based on our explanation. They were okay with that. And so I know that's just a few stories, but I do think that the law enforcement dropped the ball on ballot measure 3.
Further questions? I would thank the panel. I think it's really good that we drill into these things to try to understand as much as we can about the dynamic. I will tell you that something in measure 3 resonated with Oregonians, and I haven't heard anybody, and I hope maybe the next panel will help shine some light on that, what it is that resonated with Oregonians. I voted for local RICO statutes. I voted for civil forfeiture issues whenever I had the opportunity to do it. But something in the way that we were operating the statutes, or in the perception in the public with its fairness, resonated in favor of passage of Measure 3. And we need to figure out what that part is. I'm worried about if this measure moves forward, if House Bill 3457 moves forward, what makes you think that this consortium of shadowy billionaires won't mount another attack?
Mr. Chair, if I could address maybe a conceptual way to approach that, not specifically with forfeiture, but with the separate vote requirement, because that's built into our initiative process that actually we invented here in Oregon in 1903. We came up with this thing that spread to about 27 other states now. Measure 40, I think, is a real good job of telling the story of why with separate vote requirement works and why we can't discern voter intent from a measure that violated the separate vote requirement. As you may recall, 1996 voters passed Measure 40. Measure 40 contained 7 things. 7 different things all jammed into a single measure. The Oregon Supreme Court struck it down, the famous case of Armato v. Kitzhaber. The next year, the legislature decided, okay, we'll see what's going on here because we can't discern exactly what the voters' intent was. And you threw all 7 of those back on the ballot as separate measures. And lo and behold, the voters passed 4 of them and rejected 3 of them, which proves the exact point of the separate vote requirement. You can't discern exactly what resonated with the voters if you have a log-rolled measure that violated the separate vote requirement. I think you'll hear people try to tell you what resonated, but I think the problem is that they're not sure and I'm not sure, and we have no way to prove it unless we put these things back separately on the ballot, which is the point of the separate vote requirement.
But we're not proposing that we put these measures back on the ballot.
Mr. Chair, no. I think we're trying to take care of some of them in House Bill 3457, further reform the system. If folks want to do, 8, I guess, ballot measures, actually I think we're taking care of a couple of them here, but if they want to do 8 ballot measures, more power to them.
So we're picking the ones that we think might have met?
What we're doing here is we're trying to reform that tool. Further reform that tool, very similar to what the federal system did with something called CAFR, the Civil Asset Forfeiture Reform Act, but still in a way that makes the tool workable without destroying the tool. If a few of the pieces of Measure 3, no matter how you reform them, would destroy civil forfeiture, there's just no way to get around it.
Thank you. I'd like to call forward Sheriff Dave Vernwright from Linn County, representing the Oregon State Sheriff's Association, Sheriff Dennis Dotson from Lincoln County, And Sheriff Joe Simon from Albany Police Department.
Burright.
Excuse me, Mr. Burright. I can't read my chairman's writing.
It's legendary in Lynn County.
Welcome. Please begin.
Would you like me to go first? Or
yes, sir. If you feel like being first, be first.
I guess I'm in the middle, so that makes me first. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dave Burright, and until May 31st, and for the last 29 years, I've been with the Lynn County Sheriff's Office, and the last 10 and a half years as the Lynn County Sheriff. But as of June 1st, I'm pleased to say that I'm now the Executive Director for the Oregon State Sheriff's Association, and I'm here today testifying on behalf of that association and the 36 sheriffs. And we are here asking for your support for this House bill in the Dash 10 amendments. I don't need, and I'm going to be very brief, because I think you've had an excellent discussion so far, especially with Ms. Vidlin and Mr. Bovet about the nuts and bolts of this measure. But I don't think I need to tell you folks about the horrendous impact that drugs are having on our community. And we know that the Assembly is struggling with taking some kind of meaningful measures to combat this problem, especially when it has to do with meth. But as you've heard before, when we lost civil forfeiture, we lost a very important tool in law enforcement's box. And it's one thing that we really need to get that back. You know, the penalty is often mild enough when it comes to dealing with these drug dealers and drug offenders. And it just seems crazy that with that being said, that we still allow them to profit from their ill-gotten gains. I can tell you that the public is contacting their sheriffs very loudly, demanding that something be done about the drug problem. And quite frankly, I don't think they understand how it is and why it is that these people are able to get away with what they do. Now, you and I know that we can't build ourselves, meaning prisons, out of this problem. But at the very least, crime should not be allowed to pay. And right now, it certainly is. You know, there's been a lot of discussion about different opinions from our communities, and I respect all that has been said here today. In fact, the thing about it is, if we all had agreed, then I suspect you'd been out of here months ago, and we'd have been on vacation right now. But I can tell you that as a sheriff, and speaking with the other sheriffs, when I'm at the Kiwanis and the Rotary and the Elks and the, all the different places, and talking with the public on a one-on-one basis, and explaining the situations that we found in civil forfeiture and how it really worked and why it was working, then they understood. And they're amazed that we do not have this tool in our box. I think it's also fair that my personal impression, is there was a feeling that civil forfeiture was unfair because people didn't understand it. And this is a very convoluted problem. This bill is tough to wade through, and unless the citizens have had the opportunity to really wade into it and find out what it's like, I think it's tough for them, and I don't blame them. But when you talk about the semi-automatic weapon sitting on the table with the $10,000 cash sitting on the table with the ounce of meth and the drug records, then they say, what in the world, you know, this is a no-brainer, folks. Why shouldn't that be forfeited? You know, I believe that Representative Olson and others that have been working on this have done really an outstanding job in trying to work this bill through the system. And I think they've done a very good job trying to get all the concerned parties together. I think this bill does raise the burden of proof to the government. I agree with Mr. Bovet that I don't think it was really broken before, but if this helps a feeling of comfort among our citizens, then it's a good thing. And so I would just tell you that the Oregon State Sheriff's Association has been very involved in this process, and we support the Dash 10 amendments, and we would certainly ask that you work to move this bill.
Senator Farioli, quick question.
Senator Shields.
The difference between pre-Measure 3 and House Bill 3457 in terms of the evidence, in a practical term, what does that feel like on the street? I mean, you're saying you can still live with it. It's more evidence you have to have. But how does that feel? I mean, you said it wasn't broken. Mr. Bovet said it wasn't broken before. But can you give me some feeling for how it's going to affect the way you do things?
I think that because in every case that I'm aware of, our forfeiture counsels and the officers working the cases have been so careful about what to seek forfeiture on, I don't think that it's going to have a real drastic negative impact on what we do, because we would have proved to this standard before.
Didn't have this standard before. It was a lower standard.
It was a lower standard before. That's correct.
Are you saying you proved to this standard even when the standard was the pre-3 standard?
Well, I'm not the attorney, but in my opinion, yes.
Okay. Thank you, sir.
Senator Ringer has.
Thank you. Thanks for joining us. Right. Is the most important, ability that you want to see, is the most important item, is it cash? That's often the example that I've heard, the $10,000. Is that really what you want to be able to go after?
Senator Farioli, Senator Ringo, that's probably the easiest one to talk about, I guess, and so I think that's why it's mentioned. I think it's just as important to go after the other proceeds, whether it be the vehicles or the weapons or, in some cases, rightfully, the property. Mm-hmm. If through drug dealing they've been able to finance the home or the business that they're then using to sell the drugs, then I think the government should be taking those.
Thank you.
Further questions? Shall we go on to the other panelists?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Joe Simon. I'm chief of the Albany Police Department. I'm here representing the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police and would like to basically echo what Dave has so eloquently stated, is that we strongly support the passage of House Bill 3457 along with the -10 amendments for many of the same reasons. I have passed out an information sheet, and I'm not going to go through and read the entire sheet, but I would like to probably provide information on the fact that from a personal standpoint, and I think from a lot of my peers that I have talked with, we find this is a great balance between the rights of the citizens of Oregon and the need to have effective tools in law enforcement to combat a problem that is growing daily beyond our ability to go ahead and address it presently. And since we have lost civil forfeiture, that was a tremendously important tool in our toolbox. But it was also a tool that was not abused. And from a personal standpoint, I was not in this state as a police chief prior to Measure 3. I arrived in this state about a month after Measure 3 was passed. And in looking at Measure 3 and talking with peers throughout the state, I asked what happened here. And they said, quite frankly, we did not do a good enough job in education. And I would like to just touch on the educational piece for a little bit, for the simple fact that as I have talked with my constituents within my city and other other friends and acquaintances throughout the state, constantly receive the question, the same questions that Dave has echoed here in regards to why can't you do something about these people that are dealing drugs? Why can't you take the cash? Why can't you take weapons? Why can't you take property that's ill-gotten goods? Basically, the proceeds from illegal activities that were not gained through any kind of productive activity. And once you explain the fact that you have lost the ability other than through criminal conviction, and criminal conviction is very much as the attorneys prior to this so eloquently stated, as well as is that it's a multiple of charges. If you can only convict on one or two charges, then you lose the rest of the proceeds because it's attached per charge. It's not an individual. So you're hearing different different information, and I know it's a very confusing topic for most people, including many of us that have had to wade through it over the years of our careers. What I think the balance of this bill brings, in addition not only to putting the tool back in our toolbox, but it brings additional revenues for such programs as drug courts and relief nurseries, which I personally think are quite important in our efforts to combat drugs, because I think that group of citizens that's being affected more than any other group of citizens are our children. And we have an opportunity through relief nurseries, through the educational piece of this, and also through drug court programs, including teen drug programs, to probably have more of a positive impact early on than trying to address the problem after the cat's already out of the house.
Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dennis Dodson. I'm the Sheriff of Lincoln County, and thank you for this opportunity. I'm the token sheriff today, apparently, but so I will attempt to avoid repeating what you've already heard. Again, we've heard the term another tool for the tool belt for law enforcement. It boils down to how effective do you want your law enforcement to be? How effective do you want the ability of government to discourage people from engaging and profiting from this illegal activity? My history, 28 years of the Oregon State Police. I've been sheriff for about 2 years. But for 10 years, I commanded a drug team in Lincoln County, an interagency drug team, starting in 1990. So shortly after the civil forfeiture became law in the state, we started experiencing what it was like to seize property. And I recall that we were very critical about that prior to my coming onto the team. In fact, we changed some policy, but prior to coming on the team, there were probably some choices that shouldn't have been made, that law enforcement, as far as seizing some items, while officers through investigation would be able to find evidence that these people had no other gainful means of employment to pay for what they were living in or what they were driving or the furnishings or anything else. There was still just some question as to why seize a really nice or a vacuum cleaner, even though it was a really nice vacuum cleaner. But we learned from those type of choices over the years, and I think that law enforcement became more responsible, thanks to the defense bar. But nonetheless, also credit goes to the quality of the people, such as Diane Vidlins and Rob Ovette and many others like them in the state of Oregon, who have a true understanding and compassion for both sides of the story, getting it right. So I don't feel that we should be concerned about government raising the bar, and these Dash 10 amendments seem to make sense and help accomplish that.
Thank you. You all may have discussed this while I stepped out, but one of the things that troubles me is the ability of law enforcement to meet costs under House Bill 3457, and my understanding it's about 40-60. Under Measure 3, the information I have is that there's a limit that's only 25%. And so I guess I'm concerned a little bit about the ability of law enforcement to profit, essentially, from House Bill 3457. Could all of you or one of you respond to that? And I guess my other question is, what if the percentages were changed?
As to costs and the change in the formula, Rob Ovette testified earlier that in the time that he has served as forfeiture counsel for the Lent team in Lincoln County, that he has not billed for his services, that he was hired, part of his job when he was hired by the county was to serve as the drug team's forfeiture attorney. He also stated that, to his knowledge, that most of his counterparts repeat that and do not charge for their services. As far as cost for law enforcement, the attitude in Lincoln County, at least, was never to try to recoup costs. It was a way to try to identify revenues to pay for training and necessary equipment, buy money, for example, to buy the drugs, that local law enforcement agencies alone could not afford. In Lincoln County, for example, you're talking about Toledo Police Department, Lincoln City Police Department, Newport Police Department, very small cities, very small police agencies. They do not have the revenues by themselves to have any type of effective drug enforcement. But by combining forces along with the state police and the sheriff's office, they can be effective, but still it requires some additional funding. And had it not been for some federal intervention, a drug team in Lincoln County probably wouldn't exist today as it does.
Questions?
Madam Chair.
Sir Ferriello.
How much emphasis is there in your offices in connecting with the district attorneys using racketeering influences and Corrupt Organization Act prosecutions, RICO statutes? Do you use them at all?
Senator Brown, Senator Ferrioli, our DA from Lynn County happens to be here. I know it's something that when I was the sheriff, we were always, very frequently, we said, would this make a good RICO case? Seldom, if ever, do I remember that actually occurring. The challenges in making that happen were considerable, but I may have to defer to the district attorney.
If I may, Madam Chair, Senator Ferriello, Diane Vidlins is here, and I recall that she accepted a RICO prosecution on behalf of the Lent team in Lincoln County, as a matter of fact, and the years that case went on. But it is something that law enforcement does think about. But it is, as Dave commented, very difficult to proceed with.
Mr. McDonald, you want to come up and respond to that one? It's good for you.
Yeah, he looked really enthusiastic.
He knows he doesn't have a choice. Good afternoon and welcome.
To leave or?
You're out of here. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mark McDonald. I'm a senior deputy district attorney with Multnomah County. I run our drug unit. In relationship to Senator Ferrioli's question about use of RICO, I think that's a very excellent example of law enforcement or DAs being very careful not to use a very powerful act. In our office, we have to get all racketeering charges approved by the district attorney and the first deputy, Mr. Bradley. And we are very careful how we apply that because we don't want to abuse it because we don't want to lose it. I have personally prosecuted 4 or 5 racketeering cases, and it is a very powerful tool, and I like it very much. But
how long have you been in the district attorney's office in Multnomah County?
Almost 20 years. I've prosecuted for 26. So, I mean, we do look at it. We do consider those cases, but we look at them very, very closely because we don't want to abuse it. And I think this body could take great pride in the district attorneys in this state because we have other very powerful tools like Measure 11, and I think the prosecutors in the state have proven that they've been very careful in how they apply Measure 11. I think we were very careful on how we applied civil forfeiture. The proponents of Measure 3 were not able to pinpoint a single case of abuse in their campaign, not one. I'm not saying that there wasn't any cases of abuse, but I was not aware of any. And I think that that is a very important fact. It speaks volumes. The fact of the matter is that it was a very valuable tool to bring money in for law enforcement. And I'm not at all guilty or feel embarrassed about the fact that we went after people that had lots of money. I think if we're going to do our job, we need to target those people that are the most involved, the most culpable, and the making, in this case, the most money. So, you know, I'm not embarrassed or feel bad about that at all. In my office, we brought in close to over $1 million a year to Multnomah County from asset forfeiture. Approximately $400,000 of that a year went to my office, and we did charge.
Is this pre-Measure 3?
Pre-Measure 3.
Okay.
For costs. Prior to the passage of Measure 3, we had 12 attorneys assigned to prosecute drug cases. We have 7 today. And starting the 1st of August, we're going to be down to six. And
sorry.
And that loss of $400,000, after that, we tried to do criminal forfeiture. We budgeted that position for approximately $150,000 a year. We brought in about $20,000 through the use of criminal forfeiture, and most of that was from money that we were able to do through sharing with the Treasury Department. So we lost a lot of money, and we stopped doing criminal forfeiture altogether.
I think, Mr. McDowell, what troubles me about the sort of the profit motive, and I hear what you're saying, is that I think that citizens would say there's a tendency to abuse or take advantage because it helps you sort of recoup costs, that you might take advantage of everyday citizens in doing these cases.
Well, again, nobody was able to show a single case where that occurred.
Sure.
Well, Measure 3 did not affect, at least in my understanding, Measure 3 didn't affect the RICO prosecution.
No, it did not.
But RICO features, if you can find commonality in three instances, you can go for triple the proceeds under the civil forfeiture portion of the Racketeering Influences Corrupt Organizations Act. And I'm just wondering, faced with the problem that law enforcement's had with Measure 3, why it hasn't turned its emphasis into using the RICO statutes. Because clearly when you have these meth dealers and you have multiple arrests and a pattern of a racketeering organization, that fits the RICO statutes like a key in a lock.
Chair Brown, Senator Ferrioli, actually you only have to show two crimes are tied to a nexus, part of a criminal episode, but usually it's more than that. But again, it's only triple damages of whatever those individual crimes are. So if you're talking about a crime, a drug deal that's involving $200, $50, most of the cases I see that come across my desk are $200, $500, $50 type cases. You get triple damages of $600, I mean $200, that's $600.
But Madam Chair, I don't mean to be argumentative with the prosecutor. It's very short odds.
Yeah.
my understanding of the Racketeering Influences Corrupt Organization Act is that once you've proven the nexus, you can go after all of the assets that are in the asset stream.
Well, I don't claim to be the expert in RICO prosecutions, but I think by Measure 3 they were limited to being able to prove that it was actually after that case or prove beyond a reasonable doubt if it was similar conduct. So I think I can give my own example in a case that I have. It wasn't a RICO case, but I had a guy that I prosecuted that had 3 pounds of marijuana and I forget the other type of drug in a safe. $6,000. He was found guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, but the court refused to find that money didn't come from another source. He claimed that he had inherited the money from his grandmother. That's part of the problem. We have to disprove under the criminal forfeiture statute that it came from some other possible source. It didn't come from his mom. It didn't come from the sale of his car. It wasn't the rent money. That's a very difficult thing to disprove a negative.
Would you, Madam Chair, agree with the characterization that 50% plus 1% is enough to meet the standard as crafted in House Bill 3457?
That's what a preponderance of the evidence is.
50% plus 1.
Do you think that's adequate protection for?
I think it is. I really, because the penalty of paying attorney's fees is so high. And first of all, you got to remember is
the
that
the loser pays theory.
Right.
Okay.
The state has to prove a probable cause. They have the burden of showing that there's probable cause that this is proceeds or an instrumentality of prohibited conduct. Then under this bill, the state has the burden to show by preponderance evidence and to disprove those other possibilities that the money. I think that's going to have a real chilling effect on the types of cases that prosecutors are going to file. And the attorney's fees aspect has a real chilling effect because we don't have that budgeted anyway to pay those attorney's fees.
No, Madam Chair, no more questions.
Okay. I just think back to tort reform, and I know you weren't involved in that discussion in 95, but to talk about how attorney's fees in a civil tort lawsuit, really, if the loser has to pay, that really brings a chilling effect. And you're saying basically the same thing is true here, that you're going to be particularly selective, particular about bringing these cases because of the potential financial consequences if you lose.
Correct. You know, I didn't prosecute the civil forfeiture cases myself. I supervised those attorneys that did, and we'd have detailed discussions. My recollection, we had one case that we lost in my office at any time, and it was clear direction that we received is we better not lose any more.
I'm sure. Do you have anything else you wish to add?
Well, I just had one thing.
Okay.
In the Dash 10 amendments, talking to all the proponents of those amendments, they claim that that is the intent, but there's some appears to be discrepancy or at least ambiguity between Section 1 and Section 1A, Section 8. And my suggestion, I've discussed this with counsel, that it wouldn't change the meaning, but on line 17 on page 4, that notwithstanding Section 1, which is ORS 475-8080, be inserted after the period on line 17 and before if.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate you joining us today. Senator Farrelly, would you take a look at these and make sure those are okay?
Sure.
Let's restart negotiations here at 3. Okay. Ms. Hildebrandt, Mr. Podanky, and Ms. Burrows. Good afternoon and welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, David Fidanke, Executive Director, ACLU of Oregon. I have submitted written testimony.
Mr. Fidanke, before you get started, I need to get, you're going to die, what I'm just about to do. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3457. Open a work session on drafting and introduction of a couple of bills. One would be House Bill 2174 as amended by the Dash A11 amendments. And number two, a bill regarding ballot measure 37 claims based on agricultural quarantines and control areas. I ask for your vote in support of the drafting and introduction of these two bills, not in support or opposition to the substance of the measure.
We know the rest of this.
Okay, all right. And I can guarantee you that neither of these bills will delay the end of session. All right.
Amen. Move on.
Any further discussion? Any objection? Motion carries. Thank you for your courtesies. Thank you, Mr. Fidanke. Back in public hearing on House Bill 3457.
Madam Chair, I'm going to defer for just a second because I understand our witness over here needs to leave.
Thank you.
Sorry, my husband
no problem.
Has to get to work again, so I have to get home to the kids. Good afternoon. This session is the first time that I've really paid attention to a legislative session before, and it's been fascinating and educational. And
we need you to identify yourself for the record.
Sorry. My name is Erin Hildebrandt with Parents Ending Prohibition. It's been very overwhelming to try to follow the bills as they come up and to follow what all of you are doing, and I'm very grateful for the levity that you've been interjecting. It makes it really fun to watch at times. And I understand the difficulty of your position trying to please all sides in these issues. While I understand all of this, I've watched what to me is a disturbing pattern emerge in the legislation. I realize that this may sound overly broad and overly simplified, but the way that I feel about what I've seen is with 5077, you took away medical marijuana patients' money. Looming over us now, I feel like you're trying to take away our hard-won rights with SB 1085, our jobs with HB 2693 and now our property with 3457. All of these bills viewed together concerns me, but 3457 especially, because it seems like it would violate the will of two-thirds of the voters of Oregon. If funds that were generated to the tune of nearly $1 million by 14,804 cardholders isn't enough to convince you that there might be better ways to address the real problems we face, then please consider that there are an estimated 200,000 cannabis consumers in Oregon. We should be encouraging all of these people to become fully law-abiding citizens instead of forcing them to live as outlaws, in my opinion. From 2001 to 2002, the rates of arrest for homicide, rape, and robbery in Oregon all fell. During that same period of time, the rate of arrest for cannabis offenses rose by nearly 3%. And who are we incarcerating? The last time I testified in this building, I had a letter to the editor printed in that day's Oregonian about Dennis J. Sabin. Mr. Sabin turned himself into authorities that he trusted to protect and serve Oregonians, and that trust was rewarded in effect with an extrajudicial death sentence. His life must not be reduced to collateral damage, but that's what we've ended up doing. He broke the law and consumed an illegal substance, which made someone think he belonged in a cell with a known violent felon for his crime. Drugs didn't kill Mr. Sabin. The prohibition of some drugs killed him. Becoming a medical marijuana activist has brought a lot of challenges and opportunities into my life and my family. When I first started, I just wanted to do the right thing. It was all very simple to me. It's wrong to incarcerate people for consuming cannabis, and it's right to fight for those prisoners of the war on drugs. Had my need for therapeutic cannabis not been a factor, I likely would have stayed in Maryland fighting for respect, dignity, and freedom for all cannabis consumers, regardless of their medical necessity. But it seems, as this old saying goes, the devil's in the details. The part that I didn't understand at first was what happens when you try to break this all down into rules and regulations and the little details of the laws. Our current approach to drugs and drug abuse, as everyone has been saying up here, has been failing us. The police can't do their job. The prosecuting attorneys try to get the real criminals, and they can't. So we end up putting away, I think in 2002, it was over 7,000 people for cannabis offenses in the state. And I watched this on C-SPAN, too, and I attended Congressman Walden's illicit drug summit in Hood River. I've listened to public officials, treatment experts, and others all speak about what a particularly terrible problem we have with meth in Oregon, and about the fact that we don't have enough money for education and treatment. But when it comes time to do something about the problems we face, I see more money being given to law enforcement, while education and treatment remain woefully underfunded. It seems to me like we're accomplishing no more than applying Band-Aids and Bactine to a festering gangrenous wound. And I see all of these bills put together as little Band-Aids trying to address this enormous problem that we just can't address well enough to solve it. I submit that if we truly want to have a positive impact and reduce substance abuse in our communities, then we need to put our efforts into proven methods of reducing substance abuse instead of throwing money at our police and demanding that they solve the problems for us. This approach has never worked. It's not working, and it will not work, no matter how many more billions of dollars we put into it. In 1929, the Women's Organization for National Prohibition Reform pointed out about alcohol prohibition, the hypocrisy, the corruption, the loss of life, the animosity between the citizens and government, and the devastating effect it had upon the youth of the nation. I read those words, and I looked at cannabis and these other prohibited substances, and I see even worse hypocrisy, even worse corruption, immeasurable loss of life, new and more deeply disrespectful animosity between citizens and our government, and I shed many tears over the devastating effect that this has had upon, is continuing to have upon the youth of our nation. In my own life, when I was a little kid, I looked up to law enforcement. I mean, policemen, firefighters, what little kid doesn't look up and think, wow, what incredible people. This is someone I can call on if I'm in trouble. And the war on drugs has taken that away from me. I have watched as stories have unfolded about hospice in California that was raided. And as these people drove away with the patient's medicine in their possession, stealing it from them, in my opinion, they grinned and waved. And this is the kind of person I'm worried about. I'm not worried about the fine officers who were testifying before. But I don't think that we can expect everyone to have that kind of level of integrity when they're doing their jobs. And that's where I would like to ask you to protect us. I see my role in this much like our grandmothers and great-grandmothers who saw this terrible injustice and damage that alcohol prohibition was doing. They stood up, spoke out, and demanded that we repeal that. These our current prohibitions against the consumption of some substances have realized the worst fears of those fine ladies and then some. The damage we've done and continue to do eats at me, and I'm firmly committed to finding better ways to protect our kids. I try to focus narrowly on with regard to the specific legislation as it comes up, but I never wanted to try to appear to hide the fact that I'm one of those legalizers. I firmly believe that taxation and regulation would be better for our nation than prohibition, and from what everyone's talking about with the needs for funds to go into treatment, education, law enforcement, all these things, we obviously need ways to generate more funds for the state. But what I'd like to do is explore other paths to the same goal, which to me seems to be reducing substance abuse and healing the underlying causes. In rehumanizing as opposed to dehumanizing the way we look at each other and our personal weaknesses, I believe we can accomplish that lofty goal. Just like you, I want to see those who harm other people held responsible for their actions. I just don't want to see innocent bystanders caught in a net because we fear what they might do after consuming a substance that we've labeled immoral through our laws. Legislating morality doesn't help. It hurts us, in my opinion. And the only reason I walk free today is because I was lucky enough to be born into a Caucasian suburban family and avoid getting caught. If I'd been born into a minority race, I believe that my college mistakes with substance experimentation could have been called felonies instead of being overlooked. I remain firmly committed to educating myself so that I can educate my own children and others. To this end, I hope that you'll continue this dialogue with me in the future and that we can work together to find these better ways I've sought and continue to seek. Thanks very much for listening.
Thank you. Why don't you go next?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, for the record, David Fedanke, Executive Director, ACLU of Oregon. I have submitted written testimony as well as a couple of attachments. Among those attachments are the actual text of ballot measure 3, a county-by-county breakdown on the vote on measure 3 in 2000. As has been mentioned, I believe, by Senator Przanski earlier, measure 3 was approved by 67% of the voters statewide. It was passed in every single county in the state. There was no urban versus rural split on this issue. It was cut across party lines. Among the members of the very broad coalition who supported ballot measure 3 were Oregonians in Action and Oregon Gun Owners, as well as the ACLU and drug reform organizations. I have also attached our own table that shows a comparison between the law prior to Measure 3, post-Measure 3, and under House Bill 3457, A. Engrossed. And finally, Madam Chair, I've attached a copy of an article that was given to me by Senator Przanski from the March 24th issue of the Oregonian, which addresses a recent abuse of forfeiture law, even post-Measure 3, when an amputee who's a diabetic was arrested on a drug charge and her motorized wheelchair was confiscated by authorities. She was tried for drug offenses and acquitted. But her wheelchair was not returned to her for 3 months. Despite that, this is a good example, I think, of the kind of situation we would see more of if Measure 3 is overturned and this legislature does not take a much closer look at civil forfeiture law and criminal forfeiture law than has occurred so far this session.
Okay, Mr. Fedanke, talk to me. I know you're like, talk to me about why you think you win an Armada challenge.
Well, I should start by saying, Madam Chair, that ACLU is not involved in the current lawsuit.
Okay.
And that personally, I counseled against making Measure 3 a constitutional amendment back in two, back in 2000 when it was drafted.
Okay.
But that being said, the purpose of ballot measure 3...
But Armada is here because of ACLU, as I recall,
right? That's exactly right.
Okay.
And Mr. Bovet mentioned the Armada case, which was an ACLU case. And I was in his position back in the 1999 legislative session with regard to Measure 40. I argued to legislators, you should just let Crime Victims United and other organizations go out there and circulate new initiatives. But that was not the response of the legislature and the Oregon Attorney General. They said after the Oregon Supreme Court had ruled and thrown out Measure 40, that no, we should give the voters another chance to pass on these issues. The proponents of House Bill 3457 not only are not suggesting that you give the voters another chance, they are not even waiting until the Oregon Supreme Court issues an opinion to say that you should dance on the grave of Measure 3. It's not even dead yet. And they're saying you should go back to the old law with a few minor tweaks. The purpose of Measure 3 was twofold. One, to ensure that the basic principles of due process in our Constitution were followed when it came to seizing assets the government believed were involved in criminal activity or were purchased or constituted the proceeds of criminal activity. And number two, to make sure that the government had no inherent conflict of interest in pursuing the forfeiture of that property. Under the old system, under House Bill 3457, the people who get to decide what property will be seized, what property will be kept, and what property will be forfeited, primarily will be the same people who will have those proceeds go back into their very own budgets. Now, I'm not going through my written testimony, but...
Because I'm not going to let you, because it's okay. Much more fun to ask you questions.
Sure.
Would you agree, would your analysis then of House Bill, other than, you know, it's too early, Measure 3 hasn't been determined by the Supreme Court, and I think you make a very good argument about what we did on ballot Measure 40, and I know that this legislature, despite the will of the voters, has voted numerous times on ballot measures from death with negligence to other things, I think Barron Cougars as well, despite the voters passing or not passing. But is it fair to say then that your concerns about House Bill 3457 are basically twofold? Number one, lack of due process, and number two, the inherent conflict of interest that the government is able to essentially pay for its operating costs by virtue of the process.
Yes, Madam Chair, and let me give you specifics. But I think it's important for this committee to understand the critical underpinning behind House Bill 3457. And we need to step back to the 2001 session. After Measure 3 passed, the Interim Judiciary Committee put together a work group that involved the opponents of Measure 3, representatives from law enforcement, and the supporters of Measure 3, including the ACLU and Ms. Burroughs on my right from representing the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. We hammered out two bills. One bill to implement Measure 3 with regard to civil forfeitures. The second bill, at the insistence of former Marion County DA Dale Penn and myself, we corralled the cats and said we're also going to draft a criminal forfeiture law that would allow law enforcement to get a higher percentage of the proceeds. Everybody sat around that table, and believe me, it was hours and hours and hours over a period of months where those negotiations took place. Since the 2001 session, there has been no attempt on the part of the opponents of ballot Measure 3 to reach out to those of us that supported Measure 3 to say, look, won't you join with us in putting forward some compromise that would include requirement for a conviction, but more flexibility for law enforcement in carrying out civil forfeitures with greater safeguards in place? Not once. What hasn't happened in the 4 years between then and now? It hasn't happened this session. I've made clear to representatives from law enforcement that we are more than willing to sit down with them to talk about whether there is common ground on this issue. Instead, their strategy has been a strategy of slash and burn. Basically, they have refused to use the current forfeiture statutes and have put all of their eggs in the basket of the Lincoln County lawsuit, banking that Measure 3 is going to go away and that they'll be able to go back to the old law, maybe with some minor tweaks, which represents House Bill 3457. House Bill 3457 does not amend the law we passed in 2001. It amends the pre-Measure 3 statutes. There were a number of changes made in 2001 that would be lost that had nothing to do with Measure 3 if House Bill 3457 is approved. But here is where you get into Russian roulette. They are asking you to pick up a revolver and hold it to your heads, because if you approve House Bill 3457 with the dash 10 amendments and the Oregon Supreme Court upholds the constitutionality of Measure 3, there will be no civil forfeiture in Oregon. If instead you adopt the dash 9 amendments, as we are strongly urging you to do, that will buy time to allow the discussions to take place that should have been taking place this entire session and before this session to find that common ground. And there will be a forfeiture law in place through the end of the next legislative session.
Sir Ringo.
The law enforcement folks give these hypotheticals of, okay, they enter somebody's house and there's meth and there's $10,000 of cash and there's some weapons. You're never going to be able to get a conviction that's going to allow you to seize the cash. Can you see some compromise? And I'm not pointing to the bill right now or the statutes right now, but can you see that law enforcement might have some mechanism at their disposal to say, all right, we are going to take this cash because we do have adequate proof that it's proceeds of the drug deal?
Madam Chair, Senator Ringo, yes.
And what standard of proof would you want?
We would want clear and convincing evidence that the proceeds or instrumentalities are connected with criminal activity similar to the crime for which the person was convicted. That is one area where we would be willing to give, at least the ACLU and a number of other supporters of Measure 3 that I've spoken to. And Madam Chair and Senator Ringo, I went through with Senator Prezonsky to try to come up with a compromise bill amending the existing statute that would incorporate that principle and others where I think there is common ground. This is what the bill looked like. And when I got the amendments back, I realized this law is very complex. I think you're getting that idea today. There were things in this proposed amendment, this draft amendment that was returned by legislative counsel, that even I would want to change.
Okay, just a second, though.
Yeah.
So if the dash 9s pass, that buys you time to work on...
And that's critically important. And that's my point, Senator, is that we are too late in the session to try to carve out that common ground this year. Ideally, we could have started work on that last fall. But that was not in the cards. You'll have to ask the supporters of this bill why they thought they only needed to negotiate with the opponents of ballot measure 3 and locked us out of the rooms when those negotiations were going on.
Madam Chair?
There we go.
Just one more thing. I don't want to take up committee time, but when you met with me in my office, I raised this issue of the auto insurance, and maybe it's just my little crusade that seems pretty irrelevant to the rest of these issues, but can I speak with you after the hearing to follow
up? Well, I'd be happy to address that very briefly right now, Madam Chair, Senator Ringo. I think the confusion is the difference between impoundment and forfeiture. Oregon law permits impoundment of a vehicle when a person is driving uninsured,
That's pending
No, it's got nothing to do with forfeiture.
Okay.
It allows impoundment until the person can show proof of insurance.
Right.
And then they get their car back if they can pay the towing and storage fees.
Right.
So it's completely separate from the forfeiture process. If you want to forfeit the vehicle rather than impound it as a way of forcing the person to go out and get insurance, which is the purpose, if you want to forfeit the car, then you have to have a conviction for a crime. But that won't, but Measure 3 doesn't prevent you from impounding the vehicle. And I think what Senator Pozotsky was saying is you can impound the vehicle. The person, even if the person has proof of insurance, they don't get it back unless they can pay the towing and storage fees. And if they can't pay the towing and storage fees, that car can be sold by the tow company that is storing it.
I think the reality is that most people don't have enough equity in their vehicle, and so if there's an impoundment and a lengthy period of time, then it's just not practical for law enforcement agencies.
And that serves, and I would submit, Senator Ringo, that that serves the same purpose as forfeiture much more expeditiously and effectively, and within current law, and does not violate Measure 3.
Thank you.
Madam Chair. Ms. Milan.
I just wanted to let the committee know that this Oregonian article of March 24th that Mr. Fidanky used as an attachment is actually a case that I prosecuted personally in Multnomah County. That the seizure,
small world.
That the seizure of the property was done as evidence for trial. There was never a seizure for forfeiture. The scooter was returned pre-trial, and while Ms. Tyler admitted both in police interviews and on the stand in some ways to dealing drugs, the jury acquitted her of that charge, although they did convict her of a separate charge. And so I just wanted to clear the record that this case and this scooter was never a forfeiture action.
Madam Chair, if I could follow up on that. Under House Bill 3457,
smoking,
even with the -810 amendments, the government could seize a motorized scooter in those circumstances. They would not have to make an arrest. They would not have to get a conviction of any kind under House Bill 3457 in order to keep the motorized scooter in any other property. All they would have to show by a preponderance of the evidence is that the scooter was purchased with the proceeds of drugs, of drug money. Now, then the burden would shift to the diabetic individual in this case to prove in a civil proceeding that's completely separate from a criminal proceeding, maybe representing herself, because since it's a separate civil proceeding, she wouldn't be entitled to a court-appointed attorney if she didn't have any assets to hire one. She would have to prove how the scooter was paid for and disprove that it was not purchased with drug proceeds. That is why we have said, I have said, since 1987 before this body, that with civil forfeiture, the government holds all the cards. And just to give you a sense, the forfeiture counsel said that having the attorney fee provision was a safeguard against abuse in forfeiture cases. In only 18% of the cases in the year 2000, and this is before Measure 3, in only 18% of civil forfeiture cases, was there a lawyer involved at any stage of the proceedings? At any stage. 85% of civil forfeitures went by default judgment. Now, I'm sure forfeiture counsel would maintain that that was because they were all guilty of the crimes. Well, if they were all guilty of the crimes, 85%, 14%, that's almost 100%. If if everybody was guilty, then what is the harm of requiring a criminal conviction before you finalize the civil forfeiture? That is the simple question you should be asking yourselves when you vote on this legislation. I would submit to you, you need another 2 years to think about these issues and sort through the complexity of civil forfeiture law. The Asset Forfeiture Oversight Committee is ideally suited to be the place where that work happens. It has 3 members of the Senate, including Senator Farioli and Senator Prezonsky. It has 3 members of the House, including Representative Barker. And I could tell you in a second who the other two, who the two Republican members of the House are, Representative Kitts and Representative Patty Smith. The Forfeiture Oversight Committee is not dominated by flaming liberals or people who want to legalize drugs. It is the logical place to deal with this issue and sort through these complexities. Please support the Dash A9s. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Burroughs.
Thank you. Everybody looks really tired, so.
It's not because the testimony isn't stimulating, because it is. It's the fact that it's July, whatever.
Senator
Farioli.
A quick question for Senator, or for one of our witnesses.
Sure.
Mr. Fedanke, you mentioned the Civil Forfeiture Committee, and I'm a member. Have we ever met?
Not in recent years,
yeah.
Senator. But in the past, the committee has been very active. It is staffed by the Criminal Justice Commission staff, I believe. One of those staff members is here today, Meredith Bliss, in the back row, who's prepared our annual reports for a number of years. And Craig Prince, former counsel to the Judiciary Committee, is the chief staff person for the Criminal Justice Commission. I think the committee should be meeting regularly, and the money is there for it to happen. And I think there's plenty to talk about over this next interim.
It certainly seems like as though it might have been fortuitous before.
Madam Chair, I just want to thank him for his testimony.
Okay. My question goes back to the scooter issue. And your testimony leads me to believe that the only standard of evidence that you would accept is beyond a reasonable doubt.
No, Madam Chair, that's
okay.
I'm sorry, that's incorrect.
Okay.
Measure 3.
Mm-hmm.
Requires a criminal conviction before the forfeiture can be finalized.
Okay.
There's an exception for unclaimed property or contraband, which do not require a conviction. But then the standard is to prove the civil forfeiture, the standard is prove clear and convincing evidence in Measure 3.
Okay.
But there is a nexus required between the property and the crime by Measure 3 that Senator Ringo was asking, would ACLU support lessening the stringency of that nexus?
Okay.
Currently, the government has to show by clear and convincing evidence that the property is related to the crime for which the individual was convicted. So one of the things that law enforcement has complained about since the passage of Measure 3, and I think very effectively, is that in a situation where you send an undercover agent in to purchase drugs from a dealer, you have evidence for that particular sale. But if when you execute a search warrant, you then find proceeds from earlier sales, under Measure 3's stringent nexus, you can't necessarily forfeit all of that property. You could if you could make a RICO case.
All right. That's pretty complicated.
But
I don't know where Senator Farioli got that one from.
Well, it is and it isn't.
Yeah.
You know, under RICO, at least it used to be the case that the proceeds in RICO cases were earmarked for the common school fund. The government could get its attorney fees, but it could not necessarily get its other costs. Now, prior to Measure 3 and under House Bill 3457, the government not only gets its attorney fees and storage costs and publication costs for the property before any other proceeds are distributed. It also gets investigative costs.
Okay, not under the Dash 10s, at least my understanding of the Dash 10s.
Yeah, I don't see anything in the Dash 10s that addresses that issue, Madam Chair.
Okay.
It deletes hourly investigative costs from the costs first portion of the statute.
Anyway, we don't need to argue about it, but you might take
that. Those provisions, the attorney fee provision and the investigative cost provisions, were the cause of a great deal of abuse by some counties. Now, statement was made earlier, we don't know which county it was that deducted 85% off the top for costs. My understanding from the Oversight Committee staff is that that was Multnomah County. For a number of years. No other county that I'm aware of took that much off the top, to their credit. Other counties did not do that. But because there were no limitations on how much could be deducted above the line for costs, there was tremendous variance from county to county. And that is an area, one of the areas that Measure 3 tried to clean up by capping the maximum amount of costs at 25%.
All right,
now, that may not have been the best place to draw the line. And as I said earlier, we would be more than happy to talk about ways to get a handle on that issue.
Thank you.
If we were at the table.
All right. Ms. Burroughs, welcome.
Thank you, Chair. I'm Michelle Burroughs. I'm a defense attorney. Well, I'm an attorney in Portland. I am a former board member of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and I'm here speaking on behalf of that organization. I'm also a member of the Asset Oversight Committee with Mr. Fidanke and apparently Senator Ferrioli. I also have been practicing forfeiture law since 1983. Between 83 and 93, I represented the government as a prosecutor of these actions. And then between 96 and today, I'm a defense attorney both at the state and federal level. I was a participant in that work group that has been alluded to that drafted the two pieces of legislation implementing Measure 3 and the criminal forfeiture statute. I'm opposed to 3457 for a number of reasons. There are some facial deficiencies that are unconstitutional in this bill. We would have to tweak those, or the bill will be, as it comes out, immediately susceptible to attack based upon changes in decisional law. And the most glaring one is the fugitive disentitlement doctrine. I have briefed this, and I have won it in three different cases. I had intended to bring that briefing with me today, but it's on my printer, and my reading glasses are somewhere between here and Portland, so I'll make it up as I go here. The fugitive disentitlement doctrine, which in House Bill 3457, Section 2, paragraph 7, has been disallowed by the United States Supreme Court in civil forfeiture cases. So that section right away is susceptible to attack. Since I've already won it, I've already done the briefing, so it'll be easy to do. The other problem that I noticed with this, of course, is the shifting of the burden. I realize that's been fixed in the Dash 10 amendments. The burden has always been on the government to prove probable cause to connect the property to the crime and the person charged. It's always been that way for hundreds of years. What changed with Measure 3 was raising then the burden and adding what is known as the nexus doctrine. The United States, various circuits, not all have adopted it, but we have adopted it here. That is, you have to connect the property with the bad guy and the crime. And we narrowed that down when we implemented Measure 3 into the crime of conviction has to be the one that the property is connected to. What we did in Measure 3, though, was add the nexus to the probable cause requirement for the government's case. However, the innocent owner defense and any all other affirmative defenses, the burden always lies with the person proponent of that defense, and that can't change unless you change a whole bunch of other laws.
I had a problem initially with 3457 and the bifurcation between personal and real property. The big thing that's seized by officers is cash and bank accounts. There's been a lot of talk here about horror stories, and the defense bar didn't raise their horror stories before. I've never testified about horror stories. I was involved in the work group, and I try to avoid this building as much as possible. But
we won't take it personally.
And it's not meant personally. I would say that 50% of my practice represents innocent owners, or what are defined as innocent owners under either the federal or state standard. And they're different. The state standard is different than the federal standard. But basically, it's someone who knew or should have known about the criminal activity doesn't get protections as an innocent owner. We have the bona fide purchaser defense in the state statute now, but that would go away if we passed 3457. But essentially, my practice is 50-50, innocent owners and not so innocent owners. And I have seen over the years, my 22 years of doing these cases, is that the horror stories are not that easy to define. You want me to come in and tell you about the poor lady in a wheelchair who had her wheelchair taken and her Medicare card, you know. It's not that easy. What happens is officers go in, there's not always a lot of pre-seizure planning going on, and they take everything, and they hold it. I've been extremely successful in my practice in getting back a significant, if not all, of the assets, or winning on motions. And I'm one of those attorneys who out there, and this is what I specialize in, this is what I do. And I can tell you virtually every one of my cases, there is some excessiveness involved in the seizure or the holding. The story, I don't know anything about the scooter story, and maybe that will be the theme of today's hearing, but the scooter story is representative of another problem on this bend that I saw before Measure 3, was that the officers would seize a lot of stuff under the guise of evidence, and they can seize evidence and hold it for a fair amount of time. But that doesn't necessarily mean that it is evidence. They want to make time to do the seizure planning that they should have done before they went in and seized assets.
Does this impact that, holding evidence?
I think what 3457, we go back to the pre-Measure 3 and we get back into the same issue of seizing things. Now they have to designate whether they're seizing it for forfeiture within a specific amount of time under the post-Measure 3 enactments. The pre-Measure 3 had no such timeline. There was no time restrictions.
So you're saying before Measure 3, they might seize a bunch of stuff and say, well, it's all evidence, and then later say, oh, but now we're going to designate these items as forfeited.
Yes, that happened with a fair amount of frequency. And as a former forfeiture attorney, what was happening, we would go out there and we would need to build a probable cause, and we would admittedly hold it as evidence until we could do that. And it's not fair to the people. I had a client in Hefner who sold 7 plants. They were big plants. She was growing it for her arthritis. She committed a crime. She broke the law. But they seized every single bank account she had. They seized her 401k account, you know, to the tune of $300,000. Well, we got it all back, and we got attorney fees. But she didn't have anything to live on for the 8 months that it took us to get it back. So it's not that there was no probable cause to seize. It was just excessive. It was too much. We couldn't talk reason with them about what the nexus was to the property. Those are the things that happened pre-Measure 3 that we had hoped to put the brakes on with Measure 3 legislation.
And did Measure 3 make a difference in cases like that?
Well, the timelines and the nexus tests that were added to the Measure 3 legislation did. The other thing that's happened here is forfeiture is still available. I think it's an incredibly important and valuable law enforcement tool. I am doing federal work now where there's a lot of money laundering and there's a lot of the Homeland Security Act kind of actions going on. And the way to get at illegal activity is to take away the profit. It's a very valuable tool. But those cases are planned and done for 2 years before indictments are ever handed down. And so there's a big difference there in the planning. But in the state, these law enforcement officers still have forfeiture. There's nothing that stops them from using it. There's no barrier, just the prior conviction, which makes sense. It's only fair that if you are going to take assets because of its connection to illegal activity, shouldn't you establish the illegal activity? Now, I will in honesty tell you that pre-Measure 3 in the United States, a prior conviction was never required.
It was a separate action, and under a series of cases, you had to establish its connection, you had to establish its nexus, but you did not have to have the conviction. And that has been the law in the United States since the beginning of forfeitures. So when law enforcement and the district attorneys tell you that they can't use it, it's because it is too expensive for them to use it. There is a huge need to have that money coming back into the coffers. And they just haven't used it. I haven't seen any state forfeitures since Measure 3 was passed. A lot of them have been going federal now, so my federal practice has picked up. But they're just choosing not to use this vehicle. And they could. They could be using it on all of these criminal activities now. They just won't be getting the profits back. I can't read my writing, so I don't know what are the points. Oh, there's another defect in House Bill 3457. It's the proximity test, and that may be in the amendments. They've added back, and we've always had it until 2001, the close proximity test. That is, if assets are found in close proximity to narcotics, that was enough probable cause to seize and forfeit. That is no longer adequate under decisional law. You have to have more than close proximity. So that provision of 3457 is also legally problematic at this point. And one last point, there's a chart that Mr. Beauvais entered, and I have an extremely strong disagreement with him on this little chart on the meth dealers at the top. My answer would be yes. You can always seize the assets of ill-gotten gains. Transferring to a third party in order to shield the assets is not only a crime, it's money laundering, but it is also violates other state statutes. And if the law enforcement agency traces the assets, which they should do, they could forfeit those assets if they're transferred. That's all the comments I can read right now, but I have a lot of problems with 3457 conceptually and facially, and the amendments, the -10 amendments, don't help. I think I would agree with Mr. Fidanke. We worked really, really hard in that work group to draft the enabling legislation for Measure 3 and criminal forfeiture, and I understand the concerns of law enforcement. I think we should just sit down and work it out, and there's not enough time. I mean, I was asked to come at 9 o'clock this morning to this hearing. I was in the Sawtooth Mountains as of yesterday, so I think we all need to have time. I've been doing this for 23 years. Dave's been doing it for a long time. The folks that you've testified, Dinah Vitalins, all those folks have been doing it a long time. There's a lot of collective knowledge, and there's a willingness to make this work. And I think that that's what we should do, is get work busy on drafting a workable forfeiture bill that helps both sides. Thank you.
Madam Chair, if I could just add one other thing. David Fidanke again, ACLU. I do see the provisions down to -10 amendments that delete our ability to take the hourly investigative costs off the top, and also the provision that would increase the percentage of clear proceeds going to the drug lab cleanup fund. That was a suggestion that I had made to Senator Burdick. You have heard today that there is a direct connection between the need for this bill and the meth epidemic in Oregon. Until these -10 amendments, no change had been suggested to the amount of proceeds that would go to the drug lab cleanup fund. That is the only state funding available to private owners of property to clean up their property that may have been used by people as a meth lab without their knowledge. That fund has always been inadequately funded. The money usually ran out before the end of the first year of the biennium under the old system, before Measure 3. I would suggest increasing that amount to 12.5% rather than 10% to provide more relief for private property owners. Again, that's one of the many issues where I think there is common ground between law enforcement and those of us who supported Measure 3. This is not the way to do it.
Thank you. We really appreciate your testimony. Senator George, I'm so apologize for keeping you waiting, but
I thought I needed to go to negotiations and I needed to hear the sort of legal case that these two would make. So I appreciate your patience.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was waiting for Senator Westland, and he apparently has other things going on.
Yeah.
If you're ready for me to proceed.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, State Senator Gary George representing District 12. And thank you, Senator Ferrioli, for being here. There's not much I could add after what was just presented here by this young lady, and that is relative to what really happens out there. But, Senator Ferrioli, you raised an issue, interesting issue, and that was the idea of RICO and racketeering efforts. Why don't we proceed that way? And the reason we don't proceed that way is because we're not after the racketeers. We're out here pursuing somebody with a couple of plants, a few ounces of this and so many pills of that. And so what happened is, I personally believe, and the reason I was a really big supporter of Measure 3 was the idea that the people spotted that, in fact, we were not pursuing the big fish, we were pursuing the little guys. And they were tired of having the abuse of the little ones out here who were being caught in the process. Obviously, it's worth a RICO, it's worth a bunch. If you're going after a major distributor, the guy that's bringing in the container loads, the person that's flying in the twin-engine airplane in the middle of the night, we all know this happens. I personally experienced a case in which the police spent a long time investigating two punk kids selling marijuana. I personally knew who the drug kingpin was, but nobody would take action against them. And they pursued those two kids through the process until it got ridiculous. I actually started to be libertarian in my thinking relative to drugs. But here's the point. When you pick up and reread Measure 3, you'll realize how well that was thought out. The issue was raised about the fact that this House Bill 3457 may be in opposition to the Constitution. Well, it's in opposition to the original interpretation of what the Constitution said. When you read this, the basic tenet of democratic society is that a person is presumed innocent and should not be punished until proven guilty. And it goes through and it lists a number of provisions or statements that the people were restating relative to how we should proceed. And I think that's so important. If there's anything that ought to happen here, I wish the bill would go away, because I think it's very clear that the people spoke, but the Dash 9s give us a chance to continue that dialogue, which will enable us to deal with a decision that the courts may rule on. I don't see it, but I'm not an attorney, as far as the Supreme Court overturning Measure 3. The other thing is, you and I, it was mentioned earlier in testimony, those of us who are legislators realize that there's a growing tension between the executive branch, between the judiciary branch and the legislature, relative to overturning the will of the people. The people spoke clearly here, and they said, we want a due process of law, and the person must be charged and found guilty before forfeiture occurs. I don't believe we can undermine that without expecting retaliation from the voters, not only in our own personal elections, but relative to what they're going to do with future measures. Because let me tell you what I personally believe, that if, in fact, we come in and pass House Bill 3457, I think the abuses that occurred in the past will reoccur. The line that you were saying in which they will push, that line will occur. And you'll see a stronger reaction on the part of the people, as was mentioned by the chair, about the idea of assisted suicide. We thought we had a great idea. Maybe they ought to rethink it. Well, they did, and they told us exactly what they thought about that issue. That's them being the voters. So I think the best thing that could happen would be to have this bill not go anywhere, but if it is going to go anywhere, please pass the Dash 9 amendments.
Questions? Thank you very much, Ms. Burroughs. We really appreciate you coming back early from your vacation to join us today. It was really interesting.
One for the team, you know.
Okay. All right, anybody else wishing to testify on House Bill 3457?
Fascinating hearing, Madam Chair.
Really fascinating. Sarah George and I'm just wrestling in my mind about, you know, what we do with these ballot measures, because, you know, it's pretty clear what maybe I intended when I voted yes,
right,
or no is different than what you voted no. And I think a really good example of that is Senate Bill 1000, where you said, oh, civil unions against the will of the voters. Well, Ballot Measure 36 didn't have anything to do with civil unions. And but in your mind, it did.
But I didn't speak to the bill. Madam Chair, the issue is there on Measure 3, and that's why I held this up. This is so clear what the people understood. There's no way to misunderstand this. you know, even in the summary, it talks about the fact that contraband and all these other things that can be forfeited, but then it describes those things that must have a reasonable process, a due process of law. I don't think there's a voter that didn't read the first section of the text of the measure in which they read those basic concepts of you must be proven guilty before forfeiture can occur. Those concepts run across the board. If we would have had the Oriole here, they would have put me in the middle with Brzezinski over here and with the good Senator Ben on this side. Ben Wessel would have been here, and you would have had very conservative and liberal saying, this is not right to take property without a due process of law and being found guilty of a crime. So I think it's a completely different issue. This is so clear as to what the people intended.
Thank you.
Thanks.
So is ballot measure 37.
37, I'm with you.
Yeah. Okay. Anybody else wishing to testify?
The longer we go in this session, Madam Chair.
I know. The more interesting, the curiouser and curiouser it gets. We did our bill drafts. Thank you, Ms. Mowad, for joining us today. Ms. Harris, thanks for being in the peanut gallery. And with that, we're adjourned. The peanut gallery, and with that, we're adjourned.